just before you get to the dream.
Hi, we are
Sam,
Katie,
and Michaela from Castleton, and you are listening to
WGXC ACRA
on 90.7 FM. Keep on smiling.
Hey, I'm Spike Priggin, host of the Bedazzled Radio Hour. Broadcast every week from 12:10 until 2 p.m. Wednesday afternoon, live from Spike's Record Rack, 400 Main Street in the Village of Catskill. Every Wednesday, I play pop, rock, soul, country, blues, reggae, and other obscurities, and once in a while, a hit or two. Please check out the Bedazzled Radio Hour with Spike Priggin on WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA, every Wednesday from 12:10 until 2.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Delmar Wellness Center of Alachua, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty or give me death.
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and Philip Grant up in Rensselaer County and I are bringing you the WGXC Congressional Report, full of stories about what the candidates and representatives from the New York 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st Congressional Districts have been up to this past week. Go to WGXC.org in the WGXC Newsroom for complete coverage of your congressional representative.
Melissa Mano reports in the Times Union that Representative Paul Tonko wants to contrast the previous Congress, run by his party, and the new Congress, now run by the Republicans. The Amsterdam Democrat said to reporters at his Albany office on July 14th, and I quote, a powerful statement was made by the 117th Congress, and now, following that with the opening of the 118th, which to me seemed to surround itself with chaos and confusion and crisis, the stark contrast between the two sessions to date is very powerful, end quote. Conko boasted that when his party ran things, they passed the American Rescue Plan, the CHIPS and the Science Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act. And Conko bemoaned that Republicans are seating and putting on committees George Santos, who was elected on Long Island despite a mountain of lies. Conko said, and I quote, the trust between the representative and the representative's constituents is powerful and essential, and once that trust is eroded, I don't think you can serve in an effective capacity, end quote. So far, Republicans in the House of Representatives have passed a number of bills with no chance to pass in the Senate, still held by Democrats, or to be signed by President Joe Biden. Conko, though, says the Democrats are focused on legislation that probably won't get anywhere in the Republican-controlled House. Conko said House Democrats are working on a clean energy innovation economy, driving down the cost of health care, and making certain that, and I quote, the path forward is one of progress for the American public and for the American business community, end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
The Daily Freeman reports U.S. Representative Mark Molinaro has been chosen to sit on the House Committee on Agriculture and the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure for the 118th Congress. The Red Hook Republican said the assignments will allow him to work on issues important to residents of the 19th Congressional District, including the next farm bill, as well as the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Quote, I am excited to get to work, unquote, he said. Spokesperson for U.S. Representative Pat Ryan said in a statement that although Democrats are still awaiting formal committee assignments, Ryan hopes to remain a member of the House Committee on Armed Services. He has also requested a seat on the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, which has jurisdiction over aviation, maritime transportation, highways, bridges, mass transit, and railroads, as well as aspects of clean water management, wastewater management, and flooding damage reduction. The committee also has broad oversight of various federal agencies, including the Department of Transportation, Amtrak, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Army Corps of Engineers. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman.
Job Herbert at Syracuse.com reports how Representative Elise Stefanik is being tied closer and closer to Representative George Santos, the Long Island Republican who lied about just about everything in his election campaign. Santos is being investigated for many issues, with a $700,000 loan he reportedly gave to his campaign the leading mystery. Stefanik endorsed Santos on August 11th and has not addressed the allegations. The New York Times reported that associates of Stefanik were aware of Santos's lies when she endorsed him in the 2022 election. On January 5th, Democrat Representative Daniel Goldman and Richard Torres wrote a letter to the House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, GOP Conference Chair Stefanik, and Republican fundraiser Daniel Constan, asking them to, and I quote, proactively and forthrightly, end quote, cooperate with an investigation into Santos. Stefanik's 21st Congressional District now includes Rensselaer County. Read the full story at Syracuse.com. Patricia R. Doxey reports for the Daily Freeman that freshman U.S. Representative Pat Ryan said that despite a recent coup attempt and a sharp partisan divide in the House of Representatives, he is optimistic that lawmakers can pass legislation. Ryan said to the more than 200 business leaders who gathered January 18th for the Ulster County Regional Chamber of Commerce breakfast meeting, and I quote, if we don't stay optimistic, if we don't stay optimistic in the face of all these challenges, then we've given up, end quote. In the last Congress under Democratic control, the Invest and Protect Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act all passed. Ryan participated in the final weeks of that Congress, representing the 19th Congressional District, but this year is in the 18th Congressional District. And now the Republicans run the chamber. Ryan said, And I quote, "If folks come there with a broader sense of being American, being someone who believes in the promise and potential of our country and coming to actually accomplish some mission greater than their personal ambition, if we all come with the mindset of patriotism as a way to govern and bring us come together, I do think we can do it," end quote. So far, though, the House of Representatives has been a divisive body. Ryan said about the long process to choose a Speaker of the House, and I quote, "It was extremely disappointing to see a small group of extreme ideologues on either side of the political spectrum take hostage an institution that needs to work," end quote. He added, and I quote, "I try to be optimistic. That was really disappointing to me, but I hope we can get our act together," end quote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman.
This has been the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Go to WGXC.org for more information.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast for Sunday, January 22nd. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at WGXC.org for more news, weather, and other information. The renewable weather forecast starts each day with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The Milk Run in East Durham has gas at $3.43 a gallon, according to the Gas Buddy website. The air quality forecast is a 34. That's in the low range. And on Sunday, January 22nd, the UV index is a 2, which is sort of high for the winter. Also high for the winter is the water temperature in the Hudson River in Albany. It's 39 degrees, and it's usually a little below 38 degrees over the last 10 years on January 21st. The National Weather Service in Albany says beginning on January 22nd at 4 p.m., there's a winter weather advisory, and it lasts until 10 a.m. on Monday, January 23rd. That's because there's a possible snowstorm on the way. Sunday, there is a 40% chance of rain or snow between 1 and 4 p.m., then a chance of snow after 4 p.m. with cloudy skies and a high near 36. South wind from the southeast, 5 to 10 miles per hour in the morning. And Sunday night, the snow continues, and it could be a sleet at times, depending on your temperature, with a low around 31 expected, and the southeast wind 5 to 8 miles per hour. 2 to 4 inches of snow are possible Sunday night, according to the National Weather Service. Monday, snow showers are likely before 11 a.m., and there could be a little rain, and it definitely will be cloudy skies with a high of 36 and a northwest wind 10 to 18 miles per hour, with a low around 24 on Monday night, with blustery west wind 14 to 22 miles per hour for those windmills. Tuesday should be partly sunny with a high of 36 and a low around 21. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears. WGXC's Justin Maiman from Cairo, on his Ginger Radio show, interviewed writer Leela Philip, who has written a definitive book about the beaver and its role in shaping the Hudson Valley and North America. Here's an excerpt of Maiman's interview with Philip about her book, Beaverland, How One Weird Made America.
So there are a lot of factors we don't really fully understand a lot about the social life of beavers. And I think it's partly because, and I write about this in the book, as I would discover, you know, beavers have fascinated us for millennium, for centuries, and every continent that there are beavers, people have been fascinated by them. But we tended to study their constructions because they're so brilliant, right? They make these amazing dams and lodges. But the animal itself, only recently have people really started to study the animal. So what we don't know about the beaver probably outweighs what we do.
So what could you tell me about the beavers that you see on a daily or a weekly basis?
Gosh, there's so many ways to answer that question. It's such a wonderful question. I mean, they are wonderfully weird. And the other day someone said, you know, what's weird about a beaver? And I said, well, I think I'll flip that and tell me what isn't weird about a beaver, because they have these beautiful bear-like faces. Then you move down their body and they seem very much like, you know, a seal almost in the water. They're incredibly dynamic, and they have these then dexterous hands with 5 very nimble fingers, and they have naked palms. So when you watch beavers manipulating twigs or doing things with their fingers, like they can eat food very delicately, they just seem human-like. It's extraordinary. And I have a lot of fun describing that in the book. But then you move down and they have these huge goose-like feet. And then this really crazy tail that looks like it's been run over, you know. And it looks like it has scales, but that is not, those are not scales. That's actually skin. And the tail is so filled with blood vessels that it's incredibly sensitive to temperature changes. It acts as a kind of air conditioner in the summer. It helps cool the beaver. It helps the beaver understand if the water pressure has changed. And then it's this rudder. So the beavers swim using their tail. And beavers never walk backwards. They kind of will rise up and sort of rest on their tail. So they use it as a prop. They're just fantastic animals. I mean, there are many amazing, wonderful animals in the world. But to me, one of the things that was, I think, very exciting to discover about beavers, and I really leaned in on in the book, was they're this kind of ordinary miracle. You know, they've been so taken for granted or considered a pest or a nuisance. And yet they are the only animal besides humans that construct their world. So they're brilliant. And in fact, they can build in flood conditions better than we can. So, you know, one of the researchers that I write about at Harvard, who was studying beavers for her dissertation in engineering, she was positioned in a lab that studies robotics in part. And it was really interesting because in talking to her, she was saying, you know, if you could design, if you could figure out the algorithm and program a bot to do what a beaver does in a high flood situation, that would be a super handy thing for humans. So I think scientists and engineers are pretty excited by the things that beavers can potentially teach us. But I should say, using traditional metrics of intelligence, what's called the EQ ratio, which is kind of like a brain-body ratio that we've always used to look at animals, beavers don't rank very high. They're like lower than a squirrel. So we don't understand fully how they do what they do. And that's one of the fun mysteries about them. And, you know, not to be coy, I, as you know, because I think you've read the book, I write about this, and this researcher at Harvard is starting to, I think, crack the code of beaver intelligence by thinking about their intelligence in a different way, not so much as the intelligence of an individual animal, but the intelligence of a collective. And I think that's pretty fascinating.
So I have so many follow-ups, but I'd like to be in here. You just brought up this idea of the collective intelligence of beavers. And can you just specifically talk about what exactly that is for a moment? Because it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's possible that beavers have a kind of intelligence that is closer to something like ants or termites or bees, and is a kind of intelligence that we don't readily understand or connect to, because we think about things in terms of our own intelligence, which is cognition, right, from an individual brain. But something like termites will build large constructions based on environmental clues. So an individual termite is arguably not very smart, but they are following simple rules and responding to clues from the environment. Literally, termites will leave hormonal scents for one another that basically say, build here. And this researcher at Harvard has made the case that really beavers are responding to environmental clues, and she's identified some of them. And in that respect, by working together following simple rules, they can build these extraordinary dams, for example. So we know that the largest animal construction seen from space, because it's been seen by satellite, is a beaver dam. It's over a half a mile long. I mean, that's longer than the Hoover Dam. That is really big. And it has endured for decades. So these are constructions that one single beaver could not have built, because a beaver doesn't live for 50 years. So successive generations of beavers have been working on this one site. So then the question is, how do they know to do that? How do they know to go to that place? And she identified one of these environmental cues. And the environmental cues are called stigmergy. So she identified one of these cues as being the volumetric flow rate. So she was studying beavers out in Montana that were building dams after the spring floods. So she wanted to find populations of beavers that were building fresh every year, so she could make sure she could, you know, identify when they were going into the water to build. And beavers don't have measuring equipment, but she did. And she identified that when the current was exactly 250 liters per second, they would go in and start building. And that's exactly the current rate, the flow rate at which their dams could prevail. So they waited until the really heavy runoff was over from the, you know, spring melt from the Rockies, because their dams would have been washed out by those strong currents. But they knew that they needed to build when there was enough water to really capture and swell a pond. You know, if they waited until it was an arid summer condition, they would never get a pond, right? There wouldn't be enough water because it's an arid North Plains situation. So the water's going to dry out. So what they're doing is incredibly brilliant and it works every time. So she identified some of the environmental cues, and previously it was thought that beavers were cued by the sound of running water, which is probably true, but that can't be the only thing, because no beaver has ever tried to build on Niagara Falls, right? I mean, if they were only cued by the sound of running water, and the louder the water, the more they would try to build, they would then try to build in situations where the shear rate of the water was just too high, and they don't do that. They know when to go in, build, and have their dams prevail. So, and she also argues that we could learn a great deal from beavers in terms of better, more flood resilient dam design, because beavers don't try to build just one dam to hold all the water. They will build a series of usually three dams or even five. So imagine a succession of dams. So if the first dam breaches, the second dam catches that, and then the third and the fourth. So that force of water during an extreme flood event is being captured and sustained by five dams, right, instead of just one. So, you know, we could probably learn a great deal. And this is something I really write about in the book, that, you know, beavers really have a lot to teach us right now as we face climate change. We almost wiped them out, but they're one of the greatest conservation comeback stories, as I put it, of the 20th century. And they can help us with the greatest crisis of our generation, which is climate change. So floods, fire, drought, all these things, which are pressing problems now and we know are going to get worse. Beavers are in the landscape and they can really help us with those problems, which I think is, you know, we need stories of hope and resiliency in this moment if we're going to face our collective future and, you know, in a proactive way, and do the things we need to do in time, because we don't have a lot of time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's also, you know, you do strike an optimistic tone in many parts of the book. And one of them especially is when you describe the Hubbard Brook watershed site and what happened there, because for 60 years or so, beavers and the watershed itself was allowed to just be without any, I guess, I don't want to say human interaction. There were humans going in, but without any development or any kind of pushes into this watershed site. Can you talk a bit about what happened during those 60 years in New Hampshire?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. You know, that was a really, to me, a really important chapter in the book. And I thought a lot about, you know, how am I going to teach readers about, A, what a watershed is, and the really tremendous value of beavers, because it's not just that they build an individual pond. That pond is part of a river system, and that river system is part of a watershed. So, you know, when rain falls in the watershed anywhere, it needs to end up in those creeks and streams and in the river system. And that water is either stored and cleansed and gets down into, you know, the levels where we can use it, or it rushes back out into the ocean. And so in Hubbard Brook, which was founded in 1955, so for, as you point out, over 70 years, the land has been pretty much untouched. It's almost 8,000 acres. It's an entire watershed, and it's an incredibly important watershed, I should say. That's where acid rain was discovered. So it's been environmentally incredibly important place. So in terms of ecology studies and watershed studies, so going up into the watershed with Dr. Burstead and tromping around after her, what we were witnessing and why I went up there was to see rivers that were, beavers were returning to their, something close to the state before colonization. So these are called paleo rivers. So colonization, which basically starts about 1600, so say 1600 to 1900, geomorphologists now regularly call that the Great Drying, because that's when combination of things like the fur trade, which took out the beaver, and then the timbering of the forests and the resource extraction that went on, and then the, you know, patterns of industrialization really degraded the river system to the extent that we have what we have today, a river system that's not functioning in a healthy way. So we lose a lot of our water. And this is where beavers come in. So it was amazing to see these creeks and streams that in only 70 years, the beavers had built dams and beaver damming complexes in, so that they were starting to move and shift. And instead of being, say, a thin braid of water, what we're used to, a creek or a stream through the woods, they were multi-threaded. Imagine just a like an artery of water or a series of veins that fan out through the woods. And that's what a paleo river looks like. And so the water, when there's spring floods, will flood and overfill the banks. And then when it dries out, it will recede. And that kind of pulsing and rhythmic flooding and contracting is the ecological health of the river system. And that's what the beavers have returned to the watershed. And so it was really fantastic to see what that looked like. It was so different than the streams and creeks I had grown up with. You know, I just, it made it dramatically clear to me that I had grown up in an environment that was highly degraded, and I just didn't understand it. And I really wanted to try to share that with the reader so readers could understand where we are, the work we need to do, and I think the really exciting ways we can harness what beavers are doing to help us. You know, we can't move all our infrastructure. We're not going to move Hartford off the Connecticut River, but there are many, many open areas where we can have beavers. We can let them do what they do. We can let rivers and creeks and streams move more freely and bring a lot more water and function back to our river system. And we need it. I mean, I think the drought last summer taught us a big lesson, even in here in the East, where we get so much rain.